Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Updike, whose latest novel is Terrorist. John Updike has written 22 novels, has 13 short story collections, 7 books of poetry, 8 essay books, a memoir, a children's book, a play, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and many other literary prizes. Terrorist is a departure for John Updike in that it's kind of a thriller. Now, John Updike, before we get into Terrorist itself, when you were growing up, you read mysteries and science fiction, right?
I read a lot of mysteries, mostly English, although some Americans. I read a lot of Ellery Queen, Earl Stanley Gardner. Maybe this is in the years from about 13 to 18 when I went off to college. They gave me other assignments. I read some science fiction, and I read some Eric Ambler. He, I guess, was the real thriller writer among these authors. But yes, no, I enjoyed them, and when I became something of a writer, I thought I might try this genre, but in fact, I didn't have the mentality or the brains or the appetite for it, and this is as close as I've come to writing, as you say, a kind of thriller.
The last 50 to 75 pages are page-turners. Did you find writing them any different than your other books?
Yes, I knew that, I mean, the intention was that they would be some element of suspense and they would be page-turners. And yet when you're in a page-turner mode, you can't abandon your own voice and your own approach. So it's fairly leisurely page-turning, and there's a lot of extraneous, even some comic stuff got into the very climax of the book. It's a thriller, but an Updike thriller, and shouldn't be read as if it's going to be a John le Carré.
You've said that what started thoughts of the book was an image of blowing up a tunnel and the water falling in. How did that image first arrive for you?
Thinking of what might happen next, the idea of a tunnel being attacked certainly occurred to me. Yeah, I suppose the book did begin with an image of two men having a discussion under very stressful circumstances in a tunnel. And part of the research for this book was to be driven through the New York tunnels, one way and one the other, and to check them out, look at them again. I've been through them, of course, before, but there are also tunnels in Boston. You know, you go through the Callahan or the Sumner, fairly, and now the Ted Williams Tunnel fairly often. There's no getting away from tunnels, though that doesn't make me love them. I suppose it's a fear of water. As a child, I was slow to learn to swim, and my father took the method of my being jumping into his arms in a swimming pool in, I think, West Reading, and I somehow slipped through and inhaled a lot of water, and I remember those bubbles. I can still see them, in fact, and so whenever I go through a tunnel under a river, I'm a little haunted by the idea that the tunnel is going to break at this moment and engulf me. It's a nightmare, and one way to handle a nightmare, if you're a writer, is to write it out, and then the nightmare should go away.
There are two protagonists in the book. One is a 63-year-old guidance counselor at a high school, and the other is a high school student who is half Egyptian and half Irish-American named Ahmad. Ahmad, you've said, he started out as a young Christian, particularly based on a character from a short story called Pigeon Feathers, and somehow there was a switch to Islam. How did that happen?
The notion of religious faith obviously arises when you consider contemporary terrorism in the Muslim world, and it seems to me clear that the force of the hatred and the determination and the courage that the terrorists show does stem from a religious conviction that they are on God's side and we are on the other side. The notion that the world is a place of devils and the devils are trying to take your faith from you occurred to me, I think, first in connection with a Catholic seminary student, but didn't go anywhere much, whereas once I put it in the mind of an 18-year-old Muslim, it seemed to move along. It's pretty hard for me to view the world as full of devils, since I tend to like the people I meet and don't generally see devils, but the sensation that the world is out to deprive you of your religious beliefs is real enough. The older you get, the more erosion takes place, the more modification of that first ardor that many adolescents go through. There's faith and then there's a faith crisis, and Ahmad has not had his crisis yet, but he perhaps begins to have it in the course of the novel.
Do you think that by the time he's 63, assuming he gets to 63, and we won't discuss what happens at the end of the book, that he could ever become a Jack Levy?
he could become weary of whatever life he has. That's a danger. At 63, I somehow can't quite picture him as another Jack Levy. Jack Levy was a doubter or a non-believer from the very start, although he did have Jack Levy, my guidance counselor, at about the age of 13, did decide to give up the violin, which his parents were saving up their pennies to give him lessons in. So he had his own adolescent rebellion. At the same age, Ahmad decided to become a Muslim, go to the mosque, and his mother permissively allowed it, encouraged it, and drove him there, but she herself is a lapsed Catholic without much Orthodox religious faith at all.
I'm surprised that since the book occurs after 9/11, that the mother seems to have no sense of what could be going on in the mosque.
She's kind of oblivious, and that's one of his complaints against her, that she doesn't pay much attention. She is 40 and has a full-time job as a nurse's aide at the local hospital. She also is a part-time painter, and that really is her passion or her love. And she also has boyfriends. After all, the Egyptian father left her when Ahmad was 3, so she's finding her womanhood, her age of maturation, what's that called when it's on a milk bottle? Shelf time. Her shelf time is going down, and she's... But no, it wouldn't occur to her, I don't think. After all, the boy comes and goes. He seems to be a good student at school. He's no trouble. He has a part-time job at a little convenience store. So I don't think it's so strange that she wouldn't envision what was hatching.
You set your book, John Updike, you set terrorists in a town of invention called New Prospect, New Jersey. It's not really a town of invention because it's Paterson, New Jersey, which also you use in the book in The Beauty of the Lilies. Why Paterson, New Jersey?
I first saw Paterson when I was doing research for In the Beauty of the Lilies, which involved a Presbyterian minister who is posted in Paterson and loses his faith around 1910. So in the course of trying to get a few facts of ancient Paterson in order, I went over there and looked in the library and also walked around the downtown, and it was a pretty forlorn city at that point in the late 80s, early 90s. Did have a lake of rubble in the middle. I assume they've built something now. A lot of historic buildings testifying to a past prosperity, but the present was not prosperous, and it was haunting as an image of the kind of Rust Belt eastern city whose good days, if they were good days, are over. I came from a suburb of such a city, Reading, PA, smaller city than Paterson, but same sort of thing, so I was familiar with the ambiance, and it interests me, because a lot of people spend their lives now in these cities, and the kids are born without much prospects, unlike the title of the city, and tend to turn to mischief or else leave.
Ahmad is an iconic figure, in the sense that he's kind of all terrorists in one, and he's also himself. Do you think much about trying to make the character individual and at the same time generic? How does that work in the writing of John Updike?
Well, some reviewers haven't been persuaded that he's both these things, that he's both a devout and very concentrated believer and a terrorist and also an American boy. And in writing the book, I tried to keep him in mind as both. But if you make the boy part too real, one reviewer complained that he didn't seem to have any friends, but to introduce Christian or Jewish friends into this book would be a whole other pattern, a whole diversion, as I saw it, from his concentration as a character. He would become less and less iconic and eventually might be diverted from being a terrorist entirely. And it's not like he sets out to be a terrorist. He drifts into it, or rather I should say is pulled into it by older people around him. So, I don't know. Writing is a matter of intuition and feel, and you feel your way as you go along. You have to trust your own instincts as to what balance to strike. But yes, he's imbibed his worldview from the imam, so that a lot of what he says is not original with him, and he speaks in kind of a stately, borrowed, artificial manner that I got used to and got to like. He speaks with great dignity. He is a dignified 18-year-old, in some ways more dignified than many 18-year-olds are. Good-looking boy, pleasant. I saw him pretty clearly by the time the book was over.
I guess Jack Levy and Beth Levy in particular were much easier to write.
They were a little more familiar, but of course that becomes a handicap in itself. If you've done a certain kind of tired adult often enough, you don't put into it the freshness of invention or the will to invent that you have with a less familiar kind of character. No, it felt good to have a new kind of hero with him as the radius or as the center, to have a radiating background of more or less familiar, middle-class, unhappy Americans.
Terrorist deals with issues today. I mean, all of your books deal with American life. Certainly, the Rabbit series takes us through, four decades of life in America. It seems almost necessary, in a way, that now that you've completed that you have to still see what's going on in the center of America. It would feel that way after the fact, but I would guess before writing it, that wasn't something going on in your mind.
In a strange way, this is a rabbit book without rabbit in it. It's written in the present tense. It's about the length of Rabbit Run, and it deals with a kind of outlaw. Rabbit became a bit of an outlaw and a refusenik of the middle class order around him, so that it bears some affinity to the rabbit books, including being located in and around a dying former industrial city. But I wouldn't push that except to say, yeah, I think some of the same levers were activated by having this character and this setting. And it interests me because Rabbit was not quite typical, really, but in some way, the more I wrote about him, the more he did become an American everyman, and in some way, all of the woes of the latter part of the 20th century came home to roost in him, so that he played host to a great variety of types of American disturbed persons. And so in this book, yes, I am trying to create a handle, in a way, an instrument of insight into how terrorists think and how young people can be seduced into making great sacrifices, indeed the ultimate sacrifice. The book made me think a lot about being young. It's been a long time since I was young, and I read with fascination these, not just the suicide bombings that occurred throughout the Middle East and now parts of Europe, but also about the Columbine-type massacres, the fact that young people, normal or almost normal from the outside, are able to contemplate killing themselves and others. Maybe it's always been with us, the proclivity toward dramatic gesture, toward romantic gesture, toward absolutism. On the other hand, I have the feeling that life is just cheaper now than it was when I was a boy. All this death they're willing to engage. I wouldn't say it frightens me, but it disturbs me. I don't like reading the paper much because it's so full of this kind of bad news.
But it's been going on for a while. I mean, look at World War II. Life was very cheap in the 40s.
Yes, it was. Yet the ideals that the men in the trenches were dying for made a kind of sense. It was the defense of the tribe
right.
against them. Land, in a way, was about land. And it's hard to see as much rationale. Not that World War I wasn't a slaughter and a terrible mistake. It was the mistake of the 20th century because everything else flowed from it. But this new kind of war, if we call it a war, I think the other side sees it as a war, and we don't quite yet, although the administration does, it labels it as a war. But it's like a war being fought only by one side with everything they've got, whereas we're trying to fight it with our left hand, really.
Are you familiar with the Showtime series called Sleeper Cell?
No, but I've read a little bit about it.
Okay.
And I'm afraid that if I saw it much, I might have been tempted not to write my book at all. I don't know. Tell me about it.
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail here, but it involves an Arab who has recruited various Americans, disaffected Americans, into this sleeper cell.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is, of course, an agent,
mm-hmm.
who we learned fairly on that he's an agent, but he must hide that fact from everybody, including his girlfriend. But the others are Americans. One is a blonde guy whose mother is a hippie.
Really?
Maybe it's best that you didn't.
I think it is best I didn't know, in a way, because it sounds a little too familiar to me. I tried to invent an interesting and, to me, exciting circumstance, and now if it's all on sleeper cell, I might get gloomy about it. No, these elements are certainly in the air now.
Sure.
Double agents, sleepers within a society, and the recent headlines from Canada certainly give added credence to this kind of homegrown terrorist cell.
I keep wondering, I guess maybe there's no connection, but it seems to be, if we look at how the Bush administration functions, that hiding and lying seem to be more a part of our society, and they seem accepted in a way, as long as you're not caught.
Well, there certainly is much to criticize, I suppose, in the way the Bush administration framed the Iraqi incursion and maneuvered it. I don't know how much you'd say conscious lying was going on. I think they had purposes having to do with oil and strategic placement and the pacification, if you were, of the Muslim world that went beyond Saddam Hussein. Nevertheless, and other issues too, there seems to be a lot of slippery spokesman-like behavior on the part of the administration, and I'm not sure it's unique to Republicans either. I think it might be that lying, we can live with lying a little more easily than we did 50 years ago.
John Updike, Ahmad, in a weird way, is the moral center of the book in that he has a morality, and from his viewpoint, America looks really sleazy. Did you feel a danger in writing that, that you could almost identify with Ahmad?
Yes, and other fiction, including the Rabbit book, certainly doesn't portray America as a paradise. Quite the contrary. It's in many ways a disappointing and declining and less idealistic and makes less sense than it used to. He phrases all these reservations or these observations about America now more extremely than I would. However, there's some truth in what he sees, and Jack Levy sees the same thing of tired people living in tired cities, the American obsession with entertainment, with celebrity scandals, the fatness of the population overall been much deplored. And the fact that we don't seem to make much anymore, all those factory buildings that stand around throughout the Northeast and elsewhere are empty and everything is made abroad. All this is, I think, kind of demoralizing, at least to somebody who knew another America, the America that fought World War II, that was made a lot of things. It supplied not only ourselves but our allies and was a country where whatever its crudities and cruelties within, and it wasn't paradise for the working men and women. Nevertheless, there was a kind of sense to it, and you could see what you made, and the utility and usefulness of fighting that global war was self-evident. So we've lost a lot of the certainties and flattering self-assumptions that we used to have.
There's also a conflict in your book between realism and satire. You've got the realist story of Jack and Beth and Ahmad's presumed girlfriend, and then you've got these chapters that take place in Washington involving what appears to be Tom Ridge, and though he's not named, and the Department of Homeland Security. Was there a tendency to satirize where you had to pull back because the balance would be lost?
Yeah, I'm not really much of a satiric writer, though I guess some of the Henry Beck stories about a Jewish New York writer could be called satire. My first title for this book was Land of Fear, and it was prompted in part by the enigma of these color coding that the Department of Homeland Security was asking us to trust and to be aware of, and yellow turning to orange, and a different kind of behavior seemed to be suggested, and it had the effect really of accentuating the low fever of fear that accompanies the post 9/11 world. I liked the idea of writing about Washington. I've been there enough to have some feeling for the peculiar climate of that place. These people running the country are at the same time kind of isolated from the country. They live in these enormous white buildings, and, they're almost islanded in the District of Columbia. But, yes, I couldn't do too much of that, and maybe shouldn't have done any of it, except it does play into the plot. Eventually, it does matter that Jack Levy's sister works for the Department of Homeland Security. So some link existed between the government, remote as it seems to most Americans, and these local events. I don't know what I feel. I feel that there are enough Bushophobes in the world to supply the satire needed on the present administration. I didn't want to be enlisted among them especially, but it's hard to write about politicians without getting somewhat satirical and funny or trying to be funny.
John Updike, we started the interview talking a little about what you read as a kid. You wanted to be an illustrator and then somehow moved into writing. And here we are some 50-odd years later. When you look back, do you see any overall broad scope to your writing? I know that someone at one point used the phrase the sheer intractability of the human predicament to describe what you're writing about. Do you ever think in those broad terms?
I haven't coined that phrase, but it's not bad, and it does fit, I think. I feel that just to be a thinking animal is a kind of paradox, and that the human animal, unlike dogs, cats, ostriches, and microbes, they don't foresee their own death, whereas we do. We live with this foreknowledge that we're going to die. We also have a very active brain feeding into our sex instinct. So both these parts of being a live organism, dying and sex, I think, warp our capacity for happiness, for bliss. We have moments of bliss, but they also are moments of self-forgetfulness or forgetfulness of our full predicament. So I guess I do have a kind of pessimistic take on certain kinds of human unhappiness or tension or dissatisfaction being inevitable. And there is no happy land. There is no political system that will deliver us from our own, what Freud called, normal human unhappiness.
Joyce Carol Oates has compared you to Joseph Conrad. How do you feel about that one?
I feel great about it. I wonder how she justifies that comparison, though. No, I love Conrad. He's very noble, a noble writer, and at every minute somehow very serious. That seriousness, I'm not sure, is my shtick.
You've had courses taught on your work. In that context, how does that affect you as a writer? Does it affect you as a writer? And as a corollary to that, you also do a lot of criticism, particularly in The New Yorker. And how does that affect you as a writer of fiction?
The fact that there may be a college course or two that assigns some of my works is not like I'm in the class or have to teach it. So it's really something that happens externally, and I don't think much about it, although I'm flattered, I guess, that I get some academic attention. Good. That's, future readers, they can catch the young, and the young like me, then I have some more readers. In the future, you're always afraid of outliving your readers. That is, as a spokesman, I've been called, of my generation. That means my generation is a dying generation right now. So I'm pleased but kind of distant. The reviews, I can't say I'm distant, since I'm the one who reads the book and writes the review. It's a way of keeping my name in The New Yorker. It's a way of establishing a kind of contact with an institution. I don't teach. I'm pretty much alone in my freelancer condition, and it's, I think, relatively harmless for me to do a book review once a month or so for The New Yorker. And some other publications, too. The New York Review of Books has cajoled me into being an art critic, and I'm really over my head there, but enjoy it. I enjoy the going to a museum with a task and writing the review and trying to express. So you mentioned my early ambitions. I wanted to be a cartoonist. I loved comic strips in the paper and comic books, and many kids do, but I would copy them and fancied myself in the future. I studied articles that talked about famous cartoonists, Al Capp and Chester Gould, and how they functioned and where they learned. And it was an era when there was a lot of ads in the papers saying, learn to be a cartoonist, lessons by mail and whatnot. By the time I went to college, though, I thought my talent, if any, probably lay in the written word. And you can kind of cartoon in words. And the words are what has found a market and supported me. And I don't regret not becoming a cartoonist, though I still look at cartoons with a good eye. I like a well-drawn cartoon is a source of pleasure for me.
Well, how do you feel about this latest trend toward graphic novels? I'm torn about it. On the one hand, I like it as this new art form. On the other hand, I wonder if it's a debasement of some kind.
I find them hard to read. I've tried, and though I'm a great follower of comic strips, somehow the subtler intention, it's not just storytelling at a fanciful level or trying to raise a daily smile, but it's they're kind of ambitious, and I'm not persuaded that there's going to be a masterpiece come out of this form. I hate to say it, since in theory I'm all for it. I even put graphic elements in some of my earlier poetry and a few short stories. I mean, I played with using pictures as sort of ideograms on the page, but I decided that in my own work, at least, the words had to do it all, that it's a bastardization to bring in a pictographic element, although Donald Barthelme did it quite a lot and kind of persuasively. I'm really talking through my hat in a way because I've not settled down to read a stack of graphic novels, but I'm not yet convinced that this is anything more than a side genre.
John Updike, how do you separate art from entertainment? Do you?
Art should be entertaining in some way. It should also be instructive. Horace defined poetry as giving delight and giving instruction. So entertainment I take to be devoid of much instructional content, although really it can have that too. And also, who are you entertaining, I think, enters in. What is entertaining to a collegiate type who doesn't mind sitting down with Umberto Eco or Vladimir Nabokov and finds it terribly entertaining? The average reader probably won't find it so entertaining. Some reading demands knowledge of what else has been written, and you're playing with a form that has a certain history and has already achieved certain peaks. So it's tricky to know when you've stopped being entertaining and have become purely boring and didactic. I think my books are somewhat difficult, really. Not as difficult as many, but they're not really designed or have become bestsellers. I had one bestseller, and I was kind of embarrassed in those weeks when it was on the list. I just felt as though I was there under false pretenses.
That was Couples,
yeah,
right?
Couples. Yeah, Couples. And The Witches of Eastwick did okay, but I'm very ambivalent about how wide I would like my audience to be. You sort of want it, but then you don't want to. You want to write at the top of your form, whatever it is, and write stuff that would entertain you, but doesn't have to entertain everybody.
I was reading earlier today an interview that you'd conducted probably 10 or 15 years ago talking about the relationship of style and plot in books. In a broader sense, style and substance, it seems to me that over the past 7 to 10 years, and I'm getting a lot of books in the mail, you're doing a lot of reviewing. It seems to me when I look at film, when I look at books, when I look at the internet, we're seeing the triumph of style over substance. Beautifully written books that say nothing, beautifully filmed movies that show nothing, and, you know, content, quote-unquote, on the internet disappearing in favor of useless graphics, or at least they seem to me useless graphics.
I think it's hard to know. It's hard to locate what the modern or postmodern subject should be. The novel began as a book of instruction to the lower orders of society as to how the middle class and upper orders behaved. So they were read almost as how to be a gentleman, how to be a lady. They also have a function of taking you to places where you yourself are not going to go, so that the exotic, the foreign land, and so on are all interesting. But what the purpose of a work of fiction now is, I'm not entirely clear on it. You write out of your gut, and your awareness of contemporary issues certainly plays into it. Terrorist is a book of this century and not last. But I think there are a lot of well-educated people now in the arts who are there because they liked the arts and who have been instructed at college or elsewhere to achieve certain skills, but they don't really have the necessary simplicity that works of genius have. You know, in the end, Proust and Joyce and Dickens and Tolstoy were trying to say fairly elemental things, and it's the loss of the elemental, maybe, that we feel in the arts. They're all a little too clever and sly.
Do you feel now, it's several years since Rabbit at Rest, do you feel that maybe you killed him off prematurely?
My feeling was and still is that had I prolonged him another 10 years, he would have endangered becoming a comic strip character that just wouldn't die. But he is meant to be a specimen American, and real people die. He was real enough to me that I thought we should look at his death, too. Writing that last book, Rabbit at Rest, was in a way painful, because I was killing him by inches, word for word. My father was already dead. My mother was ailing and in and out of hospitals, and I wasn't feeling so well myself at that point. I had a kind of heart pains, chest pains, So it was a way of embracing death for me. And actually, once he got down to Florida and began to really die, I felt kind of cheerful. Rather that than now he would be, he's always a year younger than I, so he'd be 73. And what do I have to say about a 73-year-old rabbit that I haven't said about the 56-year-old rabbit? So no, I can't regret that. I did provide a sequel when his children got together in a book called Rabbit Remembered, where he figures as kind of a ghost. That's about as much as I think I can do. I know it's hard. People loved him. I loved him. He's very good to me. Most of my prizes came from the rabbit books. Nevertheless, I wanted it. I thought he needed the dignity of a decent burial. And the series needed closure, needed to be wrapped up and rendered intact. And I'm on my own now, trying to write what I can about terrorists or Gertrude and Claudius in Hamlet. You know, I'm on the loose, as it were.
Mentioning Gertrude and Claudius, obviously you're not the first person to take Hamlet in different directions. You know, we saw Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. In The Coup, you kind of turn Nabokovian, looking at an alternative pale fire in a way. Do you feel that there are no limits to the directions that you can go in at that point?
You have to be hopeful in life and in art, and I've tried these things as experiments, knowing that they could be failed experiments. But no, writing should be fun. Novels should be fun, and they should have a sense of play to them, of the mind, the human mind, entertaining itself. It's hard for me to think, frankly, of some major field of life truth that I haven't attempted to explore in some way, so that I have no novel in my head that I want to get to once the terrorist has receded. I may never write another novel, though I still feel pretty healthy, but maybe one will come. Always in my life, I've been working on sort of my last idea, and it's not like I have a whole file of future books like Dostoevsky did. I hope that when my mind is relatively blank and my life is relatively uncluttered, something will occur to me.
What do you think is the role of the artist or the writer in terms of politics or the social setting?
A writer is a citizen as well as being a writer, and certainly will have certain opinions and shouldn't try to keep those opinions out of his fiction. On the other hand, a book that tells us how to vote or even how to feel, what causes to back, I think is in danger of becoming merely one-dimensional and propagandistic and of rather little worth as a novel. The very nature of fiction, which moves from character to character with some sympathy and understanding for everybody, should preclude any simple messages as far as politics go. However, there are politics in my novels and in my life. I was raised as a Roosevelt Democrat by a father and a mother who had turned to Roosevelt in the Depression, and that has pretty much stayed with me. I've lived most of my adult life now under Republican administrations that I didn't vote for, but I'm not certainly a rabid anti-Republican. I think both parties should get some power now and then just to know what it's like to hold the power. Obviously, holding the power is one thing, and not really having it and being able to criticize other people's decisions is another. We're living in a strange time. We won the Cold War, everybody agreed, and the collapse of the Soviet Union or the withdrawal of the Soviet Union from international challenge has released a lot of demons, as far as we can tell. It's not been paradise, and we're at a loss, really, how to combat our new enemies. I do have in the new novel a little portrait, a passing portrait of the Homeland Secretary of the Homeland Security, whatever his title is, and although I make some fun of him, I basically think he's trying to do something that has to be done, and it's kind of impossible to do, to supervise closely a 200 or 300 million people who are trying to uphold ideas of freedom and personal choice and not be robots under some totalitarian system is tough. I feel American freedom dwindling away in little bits. Just being able to walk onto an airplane without having to prove you're who you are, kind of a luxury that we enjoyed and didn't appreciate it when we had it.
I sometimes feel as if we entered this other world when George W. Bush became president. I don't perceive him to be a standard Republican by any means. The fundamentalist Christianity and the corruption all happening at once. Maybe it's because I'm 20-odd years younger than you, but I see something different going on here. Do you?
Well, I certainly don't sympathize with the attempt to subvert Roe versus Wade and other liberal Supreme Court judgments, and it makes me, it's a lot that I don't like. The fuss over legal marriage, the attempt to build into the Constitution that you should only marry someone of the opposite gender. I can't say I'm enthusiastic about any of that. On the other hand, George Bush won a narrow victory the first time and a pretty emphatic one the second time. So as an American, I have to face the fact that given a choice between John Kerry and George Bush, the country chose four more years of George Bush. We're not going to get four on top of that, though, so let's look to the future and hope we get a change of atmosphere in the White House.
You had a character named Robert Angstrom, kind of an everyman American. You said in the 80s that he would have been a Reagan supporter. Would he have been a George W. Bush supporter?
Hard to be sure without Rabbit here to testify on his own behalf. I think he'd have reservations, but always Rabbit tends to defend the standing president. He tends to see the good in the president, maybe because he doesn't want to be president himself. It's important that we respect our president, I believe, in a system that the bigger we get, I think the harder it is to hold the country together. I don't think he'd be a Bush supporter. I think he would have liked, he's a Korean War vet in a way himself. He would have voted for John Kerry.
Have you gotten any political feedback on your book, Terrorist, John Updike?
A little, I expect. I've given a lot of interviews. To me, it's a book about religion more than politics in a strange way. It's about his religious life and, by extension, how religion plays a big part in the present Islam extremist movement. I haven't read all the reviews. I'm not sure I ever will. No doubt there's some political objection or some political comments being made. But it's, in my mind, not a very political book. We can all agree that terrorist acts are to be deplored, and yet the book asks you to believe that it is other human beings who perpetrate them. Ahmad is a human, and I tried to show that the kind of even of good intentions of a warped, we think, sort going into his terrorism.
You know, the novelist has an obligation, in a sense, to show shades of gray. A good novelist.
Oh, yes, I quite agree. I'm a gray man all the way, and you must try to take all sides. And it's sort of where the life of ideas enters into a novel, is when you get debates, either specific ones or implied debates between characters when they're presenting their own point of view. Absolutely. I think we are living in a gray world where we can't be too sure that we're all white. Nobody's all white. There is much truth, in a way, in the Islamic the extreme Islamic distrust of the American way of life. I think a lot of Americans criticize the American way of life. It's made us fat and greedy and lazy, in a way. Can be achieved only at the expense of a great many limited resources. So we're sort of burning up the world's gas, and we shouldn't be too proud of ourselves.
The last 20 or 30 pages of the book, putting aside the thriller element of it, consists of a dialogue between a point of view character named Jack Levy and Ahmad, who's our young terrorist. Ahmad, the idealist, versus Levy, the cynic? I'm just wondering, when you were doing that, are those kind of two sides of John Updike?
Well, both voices can be heard within you. At one point, Levy says to him, don't you feel, how can you really think about killing all these innocent people? And Ahmad very quickly says, who says that non-believers are innocent? Non-believers say that. So there you have the sort of the two possible sides. I enjoyed that discussion. They also discovered they have a lot of common ground. In fact, they've both been disappointed in romance, and they both underwent boyhood revolts in a way. So they're not entirely different. But yes, they uphold. And debates in fiction are fun for the writer, since you can spread out the various viewpoints possible. But what did Ezra Pound say? Art is not opinions. And so, above all, you are trying to tell a story and paint a picture.
I have one more question to ask you, and this is because a friend of mine begged me to ask you.
Right.
He is a huge fan of your light verse and your poetry. When you're writing that, how does that make you feel in the context of the rest of your work?
My first acceptance at the New Yorker was a piece of light verse, and it's something that I thought I could do even as an adolescent. I mean, I read there was a lot of light verse around, and I liked the idea of making people laugh or smile. It seemed a worthy, harmless activity, and so I wrote a lot of light verse in high school and then in college, and a fair amount in the first 5 years of my published life. When you write light verse, you're trying to generally rhyme and observe a strict meter. So all this is discipline in a way that maybe helps you write better prose, too. As to my verse that isn't light, and there's a fair amount of that also, to use language at the highest pitch to which you're able to bring it, compressed and many-layered, many-forked, is, I think, a very good exercise for a prose writer, even if he never writes great poetry. A page of prose ought to have some of the charms of a poem. You could be able to read it twice and get something out of it the second time. In a way, it should have a value. The words, the language should have a value beyond just delivering certain images and facts. You want it to have a life of its own, a certain musical life, you could say. And writing poetry has helped me try to breathe some music into my prose.
You've been listening to an interview with John Updike, whose latest novel is Terrorist. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.